Ursula K. Le Guin. Among the more widely read Pacific Northwest authors, Ursula K. Le Guin, born 1929, has enjoyed critical success and continues producing memorable stories for aficionados of science fiction, fantasy, and children's literature. Her work is not so easily categorized, however. It has been characterized as anthropological science fiction, magical realism, and speculative fiction, suggesting both the range of Le Guin's interests and the qualities that make a good book worth reading, no matter what genre you use to label it. Some common themes do emerge from her writing, including the fine lines between utopia and dystopia, democracy and dictatorship, language and understanding, and male and female. Above all, Le Guin's fiction addresses her concern that we are trained not to exploit our powers of imagination. Her worlds challenge us to do so by questioning our perceptions of reality. Le Guin was born and grew up in Berkeley, California, the daughter of anthropologist Alfred Kroeber and writer Theodora Kroeber, whose combined interests provided important early influences on the direction of her career. Her father owned a library of science fiction and fantasy novels, and Le Guin began making her contributions to the field as early as the age of 11, when she submitted a short story about time travel to Amazing Stories. At Radcliffe, she began her study of French and Italian Renaissance literature, earning a B.A. degree in 1951 and then an M.A. from Columbia in 1952. On a Fulbright scholarship to France in 1953, she met her future husband, Charles Le Guin, who also was studying on a Fulbright scholarship. He became a professor of French history at Portland State University in Portland, Oregon, where they have lived for over 40 years. In 1962, Le Guin published her first fantasy story, April in Paris, in Amazing Stories. She followed this in 1966 with her science fiction novel, Rokanan's World. The Wizard of Earthsea, part one of the Earthsea trilogy, appeared in 1968 and received the Boston Globe Horn Book Award in 1969. Le Guin's critically acclaimed The Left Hand of Darkness firmly established her as a major presence in science fiction as well as a rising voice in feminist studies. Le Guin has won 5 Hugo Awards, in 1970 for Best Novel for The Left Hand of Darkness. The Word for World is Forest, 1973 short fiction, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas, 1974 short stories, The Dispossessed, an Ambiguous Utopia, 1975 novel, Buffalo Gals, Won't You Come Out Tonight, 1988 novelette. She has won 5 Nebula Awards from the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, The Left Hand of Darkness, 1969 novel, The Dispossessed, an Ambiguous Utopia, 1974 novel, Tehanu, The Last Book of Earthsea, 1990 novel, The Day Before the Revolution, 1974 short story, Solitude, 1990 novelette. She received a Newbery Honor for The Fine Ashore, 1972, the Pilgrim Award for her entire body of work in 1989, and a 1995 World Fantasy Award for Live Achievement, among others. She is the only science fiction author to have won a National Book Award, 1973, The Farthest Shore. Her recent works include the third installment in her Haynish cycle, The Telling, 2000, Tales from Earthsea, 2001, and The Birthday of the World and Other Stories, 2002. Set in a landscape that juxtaposes the urban and the sublime in the forms of Portland and Mount Hood, Oregon, The Good Trip, from The Wind's 12 Quarters, 1976, can be read in the tradition of utopian tales that project an imaginative vision of the end at which social life aims. Notable early utopian works include Margaret Cavendish's The Blazing World, 1966, which recent observers have called the original science fiction story instead of the more popularly known Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. Francis Bacon's The New Atlantis, a title Le Guin uses for her own novella of Portland as tyrannical utopia, and Samuel Butler's Erewhon, 1872, a satirical utopia referenced in the following, which Le Guin has called a psychomyth, a surrealistic fantasy that takes place outside of time. Le Guin was studying Italian and translating Dante's Commedia at the time she wrote this story, so fans of Dante and Beatrice will recognize the allusions. The Good Trip. As he swallowed the stuff, he knew he shouldn't swallow the stuff. Knew it for sure. Knew it as a driver knows the truck coming straight at him at 70 miles per hour. Suddenly, intimately, finally. His throat shut. His solar plexus knotted up like a sea anemone, but too late. Down the hatch it went. The bite of bitter candy, the acid drop, the sour ball, the peppy packet of powder, etching a little corroded trail of terror behind it all the way down his esophagus, like a poisoned snail swallowed whole. It was the terror that was wrong. He was afraid and hadn't known it, and now it was too late. You can't afford to be afraid. Fear fouls it all up and sends those few, those unhappy few, a very small percentage, to the loony bin to cower in corners not saying anything. You have nothing to fear but fear itself. Yes, sir, Mr. Roosevelt, sir. The thing to do is relax, think good thoughts. If rape is inevitable. He watched Rich Herringer open up his little packet, accurately compounded and hygienically wrapped by a couple of fellows putting themselves through grad school in chemistry by the approved American method of free enterprise. Illegitimate, to be sure, but this is not unusual in America, where so little is legal that even a baby can be illegitimate. And swallow the small, sour snail with formal and deliberate enjoyment. If rape is inevitable, relax and enjoy. Once a week. But is anything inevitable besides death? Why relax? Why enjoy? He would fight. He would not go on a bad trip. He would fight the drug consciously and purposefully, not in panic, but with intent, and we'll see who wins. In this corner, LSD alpha, 100 micrograms, plain wrapper, the Tibetan whirlwind. And in this corner, ladies and gentlemen, LSD BAMA, 166 pounds, the Sonoma sniveler, wearing white trunks and red suitcases and blue cheek pouches. Let me out of here. Let me out of here. Clang. Nothing happened. Louis Sidney David, the man with no last name, the Jewish Celt, cornered in this corner, stared warily around him. His three companions all looked normal, in focus if out of touch. They did not have auras. Jim was lying on the verminous sofa bed reading Ramparts, a trip to Vietnam he wanted, maybe, or to Sacramento. Rich looked torpid. He always looked torpid, even when serving free lunch in the park. And Alex was nitpicking around on his guitar. The infinite satisfaction of the chord. The silver chord. Sursum corda. If he carries a guitar around, why can't he play a tune on it? No, irritability is a symptom of loss of self-control. Suppress it. Suppress everything. Censor, censor. Fight, team, fight. Lewis got up, observing with pleasure the ready ease of his responses and the perfection of his sense of balance, and filled a glass of water at the vial sink. Beard hairs, spat out Colgate, rust and radish droppings, a sink of iniquity, a small sink, but mine own. Why did he live in this dump? Why had he asked Jim and Rich and Alex to come and share their sugar lumps with him here? It was lousy enough without being an opium den, too. Soon it would be littered with inert bodies, eyes dropping out like marbles and rolling under the bed to join the dust and ruin lurking there. Lewis carried the glass of water over to the window, drank half of it, and began to pour the rest gently around the roots of a seedling olive tree in a mended 10-cent pot. "Have a drink on me," he said, looking closely at the tree. It was 5 inches high, but looked very like an olive tree, gnarled and durable. A bonsai. Bonsai! But where's Satori? Where's the significance, the enhancement, all the shapes and colors and meanings, the intensification of the perception of reality? How long does it take the damn stuff to work? There sat his olive tree, no less, no more. Unenhanced, insignificant. Men cry, "Peace! Peace!" But there is no peace. Not enough olive trees to go around, due to population explosion of human species. Was that a perception? No, any undrugged meathead could have perceived it. Oh, come on, poison, poison me. Come, hallucination, come, so that I may fight you, reject you, refuse you, lose the fight and go mad silently. Like Isabel. That was why he lived in this dump, and that was why he had asked Jim and Rich and Alex here, and that was why he was off on a trip with them, a pleasure cruise, a holiday in picturesque old Erewhon. He was trying to catch up with his wife. What is most difficult about watching your wife go insane is that you can't go with her. Farther and farther away she walks, not looking back, a long trip down into silence. The liar falls dumb, and the psychiatrists are liars too. You stand behind the glass wall of your sanity like one at an airport watching a crash. You shout, "Isabel!" She never heard. The plane crashed in silence. She could not hear him call her name, nor could she speak to him. Now the walls that divided him from her were brick, very solid, and he could do what he liked with his own glass house of sanity. Throw stones, throw alphas, tinkle, crash. LSD alpha did not drive you insane, of course. It did not even unravel your chromosomes. It simply opened the door to the higher reality. So did schizophrenia, he gathered. But the trouble there was that you couldn't speak, you couldn't communicate, you couldn't say what. Jim had lowered his ramparts. He was sitting in a noticeable fashion, inhaling. He was going to get with reality the right way, like a llama man. He was a true believer, and his life now centered upon the LSDA experience, as a religious mystic's upon his mystical discipline. Could you keep it up once a week for years, though? At 30? At 42? At 63? There is a terrible monotony and adversity to life. You'd need a monastery. Matins, nones, vespers, silence. Walls around, big solid brick walls. To keep the lower reality out. Come on, hallucinogen, get with it. Hallucinogenate. Hallucinogenize. Smash the glass wall. Take me on a trip where my wife went. Missing person, age 22, height 5 feet 3 inches, weight 105 pounds, hair brown, race human, sex female. She never was a fast walker. I could catch up with her with one foot tied behind me. Take me where she walked to. No. I'll walk there by myself, said Lewis Sidney David. He finished pouring the water in little dribbles around the roots of the olive tree and looked up out the window. There, through smeary glass, was Mount Hood, 40 miles away, 2 miles high, a volcanic cone possessing the serene symmetry peculiar to volcanic cones, dormant but not officially extinct, full of sleepy fires, and surrounded by its own atmosphere and climate different from that of lower altitudes. Snow and a clear light. That was why he lived in this dump, because when you looked out the window of it, you saw the higher reality, 11,000 feet higher. I'll be damned, Lewis said aloud, feeling that he was on the edge and verge of perceiving something really important. But he had that feeling fairly often, without chemical assistance. Meanwhile, there was the mountain. A lot of muck, freeways, and disposable office buildings and high-rises, and urban renewal bomb sites, and neon elephants washing neon cars with dotted showers of neon, lay in between him and the mountain. And the base of it was hidden along with its foothills in a pale smog, so that the peak floated. Lewis felt a strong impulse to cry and to say his wife's name aloud. He repressed this impulse, as he had been doing for 3 months, ever since May, when he had taken her to the sanitarium, after the silent months. In January, before the silence began, she had cried a great deal, all day long some days, and he had become frightened of tears. First tears, then silence. No good. Oh, God, get me out of this. Lewis let go, quit fighting the impalpable enemy, and begged for release. He implored the drug in his bloodstream to work, to do something, to let him cry, or see colors, or go off his rocker, anything. Nothing happened. He finished pouring the water in little dribbles around the roots of the olive tree, and looked up at the room. It was a dump, but big, and it had a good view of Mount Hood, and the wisdom-tooth crest of Mount Adams on clear days, too. But nothing would happen here. This was the waiting room. He picked up his coat off a broken chair and went out. It was a good coat, lamb's wool lining and a hood and all that. His sister and mother had clubbed to get it for him for Christmas, making him feel like R.R. Raskolnikov. But he was not going to murder any old pawnbrokers today, not even a suicide. On the stairs he passed the painters and plasterers with their ladders and buckets, three of them, going up to do his room over, peaceful-looking, fresh-faced men in their 40s and 50s. Poor bastards, what would they do with the sink? With the three Alfies, Rich and Jim and Alex, who on honeydew had fed and drunk the milk of paradise, with his notes on Lenotre, Olmsted, and McLaren, with his 14 pounds of photographs of Japanese domestic architecture, with his drawing board and fishing tackle, his collected works of Theodore Sturgeon, bound in sensational cardboard, the 8-by-10-inch unfinished oil of an ataxic nude by a painter friend whose auto loan company had attached his paintings, Alex's guitar, the olive tree, the dust and eyeballs under the bed. That was their problem. He went on down the rooming house stairs that smelled of old tomcat, and heard his hiking boots clomping heartily. He felt that all this had happened once before. It took him a long time to get out of the city, since public transportation was forbidden to people in his condition. Of course, he couldn't get on the Gresham bus, which would have saved a lot of time, taking him through the suburbs and halfway there. But there was plenty of time. The summer evening would stay light. He could count on it. Lenient and sweet in their length are the twilights of a latitude halfway between equator and pole. No tropic monotonies, no Arctic absolutes, but a winter of long shadows and a summer of long dusks. Gradations and accommodations of brightness, attenuations of clarity, subtleties and leisures of the light. Children scuttered in the green parks of Portland, and down long side streets, all at one great game over all the city, the game of young. Only here and there a kid went alone, playing solitude for higher stakes. Some kids are gamblers born, bits of trash scraped along the gutters, moved by a warm wind now and then. There was a great, sad sound far off over the city, as if lions were roaring in cages, walking and lashing their gold sides with gold-tasseled tails, and roaring, roaring. Sunset, somewhere west over roofs, but not for the mountain that still burned with a white fire away up high. As Lewis left the last of the city and went through a pleasant land, hilly and well-farmed, the wind began to smell of wet earth, cool, complex, as it will as night comes on. And past Sandy there was darkness under great increasing forests on the rising slopes. But there was plenty of time. Above and ahead the peak stood white, faintly tinged with apricot in sunlight. As he climbed the long, steep road, he came out again and then again from the dark forests into gulfs of yellow clarity. He went on until he was up above the forests and up above the darkness, on heights where there was only snow and stone and air and the vast, clear, enduring light. But he was alone. That wasn't right. He hadn't been alone when this had happened. Where? No skis, no sled, no snowshoes, not even an inner tube. If I had got the commission for this landscape, God, I would have put a path along here, sacrificing grandeur for convenience. But only a little path, no harm. Only a little crack in the Liberty Bell, only a little leak in the dike, fuse on the bomb, maggot in the brain. Oh, my mad girl, my silent love, my wife whom I sold into Bedlam because you would not hear me speak, Isabel, come save me from yourself. I've climbed after you up above all the paths, and now I stand here alone. There isn't any way to go. Daylight died away, and the white of the snow went somber. In the east, above endless, darkening ranges and forests, and pale, hill-enfolded lakes, Saturn shone bright and saturnine. Lewis did not know where the lodge was, somewhere on the timberline, but he was above timberline. He would not go down. To the heights, Excelsior! A youth who bore mid snow and ice a banner with this strange device. Help, help, I am a prisoner of the higher reality. He climbed. He climbed unclomben slopes, unkempt, and as he climbed, he wept. His tears crawled down over his face, and he crawled up over the mountain's face. The very high places are terrible, alone at dusk. The light no longer stayed for him. There was no longer plenty of time. He had run out of time. Stars came out and looked at him eye to eye out of the gulfs of darkness whenever he glanced aside from the huge white up-tilted plain, the higher plane he climbed. On either side of him there was a gap with a few stars in it. But the snow kept its own cold light, and he kept climbing. He remembered the path when he came across it. God or the state or he himself had put a path there on the mountain after all. He turned right, and it was wrong. He turned left and stood still. He did not know which way to go, and shaking with cold and fear, he cried out aloud to the death-white summit above him and to the black places in between the stars his wife's name. Isabel. She came along the path out of the darkness. I began to get worried about you, Lewis. I went farther than I meant to, Lewis said. It stays light so long up here, you sort of think it'll go on forever. Right. I'm sorry I worried you. Oh, I wasn't worried, you know, lonesome. I thought maybe your leg had slowed you down. Is it a good hike?
Spectacular.
Take me along tomorrow. Didn't you enjoy skiing? She shook her head. Not without you, she muttered, shamefaced. They went leftward down the path, not very fast. Lewis was still slightly hobbled by the pulled muscle that had kept him off skis the last 2 days, and it was dark, and there wasn't any hurry. They held hands. Snow, starlight, stillness. Fire underfoot, darkness around. Ahead of them, firelight, beer, bed. All things in their due time. Some, born gamblers, will always choose to live on the side of a volcano. When I was in the sanitarium, Isabel said, pausing so that he too stopped, and there was no longer even the noise of their boots on the dry snow. No sound at all but the soft sound of her voice. I had a dream like this, awfully like this. It was the most important dream I had. Yet I can't recall it clearly. I never could, even in therapy. But it was like this, this silence, being up high, the silence above all, above all. It was so silent that if I said something, you would be able to hear it. I knew that. I was sure of it. And in the dream, I think I said your name, and you could hear me. You answered me. Say my name, he whispered. She turned and looked at him. There was no sound on the mountain or among the stars. She said his name. He answered, saying hers, and then took hold of her. Both of them were shaking. It's cold, it's cold. We've got to go down. They went on their tightrope, between the outer and the inner fires. Look at that enormous star. Planet, Saturn, Father Time. Ate's children, didn't he? She murmured, holding hard to his arm. All but one of them, Lewis answered. Down a long, clear slope before them now, they saw in gray starlight the bulk of the upper hut. The towers of the ski lift, vague and gaunt, and the vast downsweep of the lines. His hands were cold, and he slipped off his gloves a minute to beat them together. But this was hard to do because of the glass of water he was holding. He finished pouring the water in little dribbles around the roots of the olive tree and set down the glass beside the mended flower pot. But something still remained in his hand, folded into the palm like a crib for a high school French final. Que je fous, que tu fous, qu'il fous, small and sweat stuck. He opened his hand and studied the item for some while. A message. From whom to whom? From grave to womb. A little packet, sealed, containing 100 milligrams of LSDA and sugar. Sealed? He remembered with precision and in order, opening it, swallowing the stuff, the taste of it. He also remembered with equal order and precision where he had been since then, and knew that he had not been there yet. He went over to Jim, who was just exhaling the breath he had been inhaling as Lewis began to water the olive tree. Deftly and gently, Lewis tucked the packet into Jim's coat pocket. "Aren't you coming along?" Jim asked, smiling a mild smile. Lewis shook his head. "Chicken," he murmured. It was hard to explain that he had already come back from the trip he had not made. Besides, Jim wouldn't hear him. He was off where people don't hear and can't answer, walled in. "Have a good trip," Lewis said. He got his raincoat. Dirty poplin, no fleece lining. "Hold on, wait." And went down the stairs, out into the streets. The summer was ending, the season changing. It was raining, but not dark yet, and the city wind blew in great cool gusts that smelled of wet earth and forests and the night.